This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. Welcome to A Life in Film.
I'm Elliot James Langridge. I'm an actor, writer, and apparently a podcaster. And I love film. This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
One of Britain's finest directors, from Othello and An Ideal Husband, to Dorian Gray and the best of the Johnny English movies, most recently directing Michael Caine in what could be quite possibly his last on-screen performance in The Great Escaper. Our guest today is director Oliver Parker.
It's a life and fail!
Hey,
Oliver, how are you?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Sorry to rush you around. Sounds like you're really busy.
Sorry, I'm late.
Oh, no, it's all good.
I had a shorter day than I do. It's been racing around town. So it's good to sit down.
Good. Well, hopefully this won't be it'll be quite a relaxed chat. It's not like work.
No, exactly. In fact, well, I've just got myself a beer. So
very good.
That's my intention.
That is a good start. Okay, wicked. I was just going to say that basically on this podcast, what we usually do is obviously go back to the beginning, talk about everything from the start and how you began. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit about how you were an actor first and things like that. What was the most fun project that you've ever done that you've really enjoyed making, regardless of the outcome?
Othello.
And that was your first film, was it?
It was, yeah. It was.
And you adapted the screenplay for that one?
I did, yeah.
How did that come about? I mean, in terms of obviously acting and then suddenly you started writing. Othello is quite a hardcore thing to go, I'm going to write a feature film.
Yeah, well, it's quite a long story, but I basically had been an actor for a few years and mainly on stage. I'd done some telly, but nothing that was really grabbing me, like I'd been in Casualty for about a year. And I just found that theatre was my main home, and I'd played Iago on stage, and we'd been touring that show for a while, and I completely got obsessed with it. I just thought, this is the most amazing show. And there was one particular performance I remember in Milford Haven in Wales, and it was a tour, so you had to do these sometimes ridiculous 10:30 in the morning show to 500 kids who were kind of just looking at the script. They had the books there, and I was on stage all the time. Iago was played that he was watching everything, so I got to watch everything. It was like having my own huge focus group. And at the interval, they all went and got crisps. So the second half, it sounded like it was raining like crazy. And trying to get their attention became a kind of obsession and a challenge. And I thought, we're not doing it right. I thought, for me, I was obsessed. I thought, this is a fantastic kind of erotic thriller. And it just felt a bit conventional. It was a perfectly good production, a terrific theatre director to whom I owe a lot. He taught me a lot, both as an actor and about directing. And I resolved then, I thought I'd go and do my own version of it. I was going to go and do it maybe at the Riverside or the Tricycle in London, a sort of smaller but good fringe theatre. But I'd done quite a lot of that up till then. I'll circle back to that later if you want. But basically, I just thought, I'll make it sharper. I'll make it feel more modern. And then my sister-in-law, Anna, married to my brother, Nat, who's an actor, she was playing Desdemona in the production where I was playing Iago. And it was she who said, The way you talk about this production, it's all visual, all solutions to the complicated thing of visual. You should make a film of it. And I thought, don't know about that. And then I realized she was right. So I started the adaptation. While I was still working on other shows, I got into the Casualty thing for ages. So the original intention was to do a production where I would play Iago, and I'd find some great director to come and do it. And
I was going to say, I wondered if that was ever the idea that you would.
That was the spur originally, but before that, okay, I'll jump back before that now. in a flashback kind of way, I've been working with flashback like crazy in the recent film, and so my head's a bit like that. But I'd been working in theatre. I started in theatre when I was about 19. I'd gone to Cambridge University, but I left after a few weeks because I joined a company called the Dog Company in my year off, and it was run by a guy called Clive Barker. Clive Barker's a guy who made things like Hellraiser and Nightbreed, and he's an absolute genius. He is, and I don't think I've used that term for anybody I've ever met, apart from Clive. He's just got this incredible imagination and just weaving stories, and they're all kind of mythic and kind of inspiring and challenging. And so I went and worked. I left Cambridge after a few weeks to stay with the company. I thought it'd just be a holiday job, I fell in love with it. And so I used to tour around doing these shows on the dole, really, and up to Edinburgh and around the country. We had a little van and took it to all these places. In that little company, we all did everything. So we did I wrote a little play. It was more of an adaptation, really, about William Blake. And then I designed bits of, we all kind of did publicity and everything. And it was fabulous. And it was actually like a shape of a company I've always tried to get back to. In other words, working with people I adore, doing stuff we adore doing. And when it's not a job at all, just trying to avoid doing any work, really just doing stuff one really wanted to do, you know? And that was very exciting. But it lasted about 3 years because after that point, Clive got picked up by Hollywood and went right off there and did his Hellraiser from there, which kind of came from our theatre company as an idea. So I was already used to a bit of directing. And after that, I did a bunch of fringe shows. I had a company with a couple of mates and we used to put on plays mainly in London, but go to Edinburgh and mainly new writing. And then I thought, I've got to get a proper job because it was all for nothing, really. So I concentrated on acting, and that was pretty good. I did enjoy it, and I loved theatre, but I ended up a lot in rep theatre touring, and I got to play in Important to Be Earnest, which I turned into a film later. So the inspirations were very clear. But it was a lot to do with wanting to get that audience, whether it was those kids in Milford Haven or whether it was the really usually quite elderly crew in, say, Bath or Bristol sitting down to watch a matinee, and you're going, Oscar Wilde, how do we make this exciting and fresh? They almost turn into the opposite of what I felt they must have been originally. They become these sort of traditional events where people are not really listening to them, and they're not responding to the energy that's pulsing through them. So my intention was to find these shows and bring them out, bring them to a kind of wider audience and with a kind of energy and contemporary feel. So that's what Othello was. And I thought originally I would play Iago, but then the further I got into it, the more, and I met some directors, I just thought, that's not what I mean. I just thought, I see it a bit differently from that. And then at a certain point, I can't remember who it was. Was it Anna again? My sister-in-law? I don't know. But it was like, maybe you should direct it. And I thought, oh, interesting. And I'd done some theatre directing by at this point in my theatre company. I'd done bits here and there, but not really, not much. And so I thought, and also not with Scream. So I wrote some short films while I was doing Casualty, and we made them three. And it was enormous fun. I had a really good time and just wrote these little stories, a kind of thriller or a fantasy. And what's the last one? Oh, yeah. Helena Bonham Carter and Reese Ifans in the first little short film called Little Love.
Not bad.
They were great. I've been working with Reese and in the open air theatre in Regent's Park, and Helen and I worked with on stage as well. So the advantage of being an actor, becoming a director, was that you knew a lot of people, you'd work with them, and they were looking to help you. And so I did these short films anyway, and had a really fun time, and they did well. They went to little festivals and did well. And it just made me think maybe I could do it. And so that's when I decided to sack myself as Iago, and which is quite galling, but I took it quite well, because I found quite a good replacement in Ken Branagh, who was somebody I knew of. Yeah, he did, you know, he needed a break. And so I sent it to him, and he was amazingly proactive. He read it kind of over the weekend and said, when can we do this? It's got to be now. And I'm going, what do you mean? He had plans, the way Ken has, loads of things going on, and his kind of destiny was already written, and he knew where he was going to go, and he knew he was going to be making Hamlet with Castle Rock. Was it the end of the year or something? And this was February, so can we do it now? I was planning to do it a bit later. I don't know. So we all went off to LA and had him, and I was looking for Lawrence Fishburne. He was the guy that I had in my mind. I was expecting not to get him, obviously, but once I had Ken, suddenly doors were opening. And
that's an amazing cast, isn't it? For
film. Oh, God. I mean, first film. It was astonishing, actually. Yeah. It spoilt me in a way. It felt like it was so fast, the whole thing. You know, it was so fast from the moment I went out there really to get cast, but because I got them and I went to see Fishburne, he was halfway through the meeting, he says, I want to do this. And it was like he had his people with him, and they were going, you don't sort of say that, you know, you talk about it first. And he said, no, I want to do this. And he loved Ken. And so I had to go straight to Shepperton from the airport. I remember, didn't have time to go home to get into pre-production to try and meet these dates to get the thing done in time. So it was a hell of a race. And when I say it was my favorite film, it's partly because it was just like everything was new all the time. Where am I going now? You know, and a sort of living off my wits. But I had a lovely team. And Castle Rock, who produced it and financed it, were amazingly supportive. In fact, that was the very good advice of the Americans I'd seen out there when I was pitching the show, was they are good with first-timers. And so my brother was in it playing Cassio, my sister-in-law Anna, who'd been playing Desdemona with me, played Amelia and almost stole the show. She was amazing. They both were. And so it was a bit like taking one of my small teams, because I use the same DP that done my short films. I use Charlie, the composer, who's an old mate of mine.
Amazing.
Who's done short films. They allow me to take my gang to make the film. Which may have not always been entirely right, and that probably I might have benefited from a little more experience from other wiser heads, but at the same time, it was hugely exciting. And
how old would you have been?
Was 35.
35.
So not young, but I'd been acting.
Don't say that. 35 is really young.
I mean, not, you know, Castle Rock assumed, because I hadn't done much more in the way of directing, I was a young buck, but really I'd been 15 years of acting already, and I'd worked with different directors. So I'd learned a lot. And the real key was I knew about performance. In a way, as a director, you tend to have a strength and weakness. Very rare that you get both. And some directors definitely do, are visual, and they are great with actors. But for me, it was about knowing how to tell the story through performance mainly. I watch the film now, and part of me would love to make it again, because I know a lot more about cinema. But at the same time, it did have a kind of honesty and was very untricksy. And it was it was almost like the camera was in the circle with them. I was almost like one of the actors rather than stepping back, because I was so involved with it. But so I learned a hell of a lot every day. And and it was a real pleasure. And you know, the acting, other actors feel much safer when they know they're working. Well, you'll know this when you're working with a director who's got some experience of that.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Lacking in other areas. Technically, I didn't know enough, but had a lovely DP who did my short film as well. And, you know, so there's a lot of support. And it also did this thing. I remember there was a moment where I looked at the kind of call sheet and it's like, Jesus Christ, it's Ken Branagh, Lawrence Fishburne, Irene Jacob, who was wonderful, Three Colors. Blue, or yeah, I think it was blue. Yeah, or was it red? Anyway, she was fantastic. And they, and I thought, how come I get to do this? And then I realized the one thing I had really was, because I'd really worked on the adaptation.
Mm-mm.
And I knew the thing inside out. All I had was that. That was the thing. I could work with them and get the performances. I knew how they were. But the most important thing was that it was my point of view on the story. And that's the thing that I always try to find is where are you in this? And that's the thing that makes it possible otherwise, because you're bound to, there's so many things that can trip you up. You have to hang on to things as a director, things that you really believe in. And it was, having had the chance to do the adaptation, there was that version of the story, the same thing that at Milford Haven made me want to reach out and grab these kids and bring them into the screen and say, well, look at this, bloody exciting, stop looking at the book, is what fueled the kind of energy to make it.
I have to admit, out of all, I've seen a lot of your films, probably 80% of them, that's one that I haven't seen. So I'm, now that you've talked about it, I really want to watch it, actually. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. But as you say, it's what an incredible cast off the bat. And I know all the people that are in it now, they've become even more well-known and renowned than they were at the time, but they'd still done a lot. All of them had done a lot at that point.
Yeah.
Were you ever tempted to have just a small part in it?
I took a small part in one of the Oscar Wilde films I made, and I slightly regretted it.
Really?
I mean, only because it just felt like, felt a little bit wanky.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt I did enjoy, I loved having my brother and friends, and, you know, I worked with a lot of friends. But there was just something, it worked for some people. Some people do it brilliantly. Mm. A bit like Ken can play the lead and direct. For me, actually, I found having in those short films, I was in one of them and not in two. And I much preferred, I realized, getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and not worrying that I look like shit, that I could concentrate on everybody else. Yeah. I could, because the interestingly, I think my performance benefited from me directing, because I was just not too self-conscious. I was just part of the thing. But from a directing point of view, I wanted just the clarity of my senses on these other people and the pieces in play, and not that way, but that way.
Mm-mm. Do you find that, obviously, you've been a director, producer, writer, director. Is there, out of all those things, what would you say is the most difficult? Like, they're all completely different disciplines, but is there one that you would particularly say is the hardest?
I don't think you can do that. I think sometimes acting is really hard. There were days when I was an actor sometimes that I was reasonably confident, young actor, but days when suddenly you could completely lose your bottle and what the hell am I doing here? And it's and you almost can't put two words together, and that's a nightmare. But having had that experience really helps me as a director to understand what my collaborators are maybe going through. But so that can be really tough. But at the same time, as a director, sometimes I miss acting. I haven't really been tempted back. I almost be interested just to... Actually, it's meant to be a quick fire question.
No, it's good. Because if you run away with it, then it's interesting to hear the details. Yeah, honestly. No, that, what
sometimes
you're saying
as a director, you feel that you want to... I miss the simplicity. I mean the focus that an actor has, you know, that an actor is, in a way, that's the point of what they're doing, is they're looking down a very particular plane of their character. Whereas a director, you are kind of thinking 360, which I love, and it probably suits me as a personality. I think I wasn't very good on screen, in that I was a bit self-conscious, which I didn't feel on stage, because on stage you're directing anyway, in a way. No one's saying cut. You're on there, it's your timing, and you feel relationship, even with an audience, is you command that to some extent. And I think I'm probably a bit of a control freak and enjoyed that, whereas on screen, I would be, but fucking camera. And so sometimes I would like to see whether I've got better at it, having watched and worked with some wonderful actors, just to see, because I love that process. So I'm really interested in that discipline. But sometimes directing is so complicated and exhausting, and you can't put it down. You know, you can't. There's not a way in which, at the end of the day, you're still thinking about shooting the next scene in the morning, and so for that period, it completely consumes you. I love it, but it is exhausting. So it better be something worth making.
Would you ever be tempted, as you said there, kind of, you do like the idea of maybe doing a little part or anything else? Would you ever go back to doing a bit of acting, do you think?
I could do. One or two friends have threatened to offer me parts possibly. It depends what it is. It's so weird to consider it being 25 years older than I was when I last did it, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it would be intriguing to see what I might have learned from watching Lawrence Fishburne's incredible stillness, for example, the absolute focus. Watching, well, all sorts, you know, Reese Witherspoon doing some, oh, wow, the kind of energy that she brought to seeing all those things close up was, you know, is a privilege. And hoping, be interested to know if some of it has rubbed off.
Well, I do what you mentioned there before about being, if you're being directed by someone that has some sort of acting background, definitely I felt it, like, when, you know, only briefly got to work with you, but it's that thing of just the understanding of, like, giving it a little bit of space and a little bit of time, and the directions being on point. And sometimes it can be, you can be given a direction that you're like, what? And it's like hard to understand, but you were very concise, and I could feel straight away before you've mentioned that you'd done a bit of acting in the past. I can't remember where that came up, but you did mention it.
Going back.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, it's that relationship between actor and director where you feel comfortable. I think that's such an important thing with the cast. As long as the actor is comfortable, then they can play and they can experiment.
You were very good at that, I have to say. It was not, it's not an easy thing coming in for, was it just a day?
It was literally a day.
Kind of half a day, in fact, because we were shooting so fast. We'd come from some other scene, hadn't we? And then we had to do that one.
And it was
your scene in a way. So it's not an easy thing to come into an environment like that where you've got a whole machine working well together after some weeks and just have to, and we changed a lot of the lines, didn't we?
Yes, you did.
I mean, the script was alive, I remember. It was one of those things where, yeah, they had so little time to write it that we were still working as we went.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I was,
well, yeah,
I was like, oh my god, because I'm dyslexic, I'm sure I mentioned that.
I remember.
At the time. Yeah, I was like, I'm dyslexic, forgive me. But
were great. You were really, but also you were very alive to it and responding spontaneously. And and the scene needed that. It was a kind of, you know, set in the 60s. It wanted that kind of vibe, which you slotted into really well.
It is one of those things that if you say to me, oh, here's a load of script changes and different lines and stuff, I panic. But then if you just go, oh, just improvise, that's my, like, happy place. And so I know it's the opposite for some actors.
Yeah.
I you know, those lines changing, I think I got them 6 p.m. the night before.
Ah, and I was like, a lot of warning compared to many.
Sorry about that. No, it's absolutely fine. But you put me at ease, and that I think that really helps when a director has, you know, experienced that pure panic of like, oh my god, I've got to now, like, pull this out of the bag, sort of thing. So, thank you.
Not at all.
In danger of making this all about me, let's get back to
you. Yeah. I'll ask you a few quick questions, shall I?
Obviously, writing Othello and then deciding that you're like, oh, this is interesting, I can write, direct, still doing a bit of acting. But then you went on and obviously did, like, The Importance of Being Earnest, Ideal Husband, movies like this, which obviously are big successes. Was there a point where you went, oh, actually, I've decided that directing is, you know, it's going well, and this is maybe, it must be really difficult. I'm thinking from my point of view. If I ever decided to sort of try and go into maybe, I do a bit of writing, but like if I decided to sort of try and sell a script or become a director, whatever, letting go of that initial dream, That must be, was that quite difficult? Or because you'd found something that you knew you were good at, was it okay?
It was okay, actually, because I never felt that the door was closed to going back.
Right, and it still isn't.
No, still isn't. Slightly ajar, but no, it was fine because it was so exciting, the actual directing bit, and because it was day by day, it was like I finished shooting. Now what? Oh yeah, editing. It's like sort of, oh, this is new. Music. Oh yeah. And so everything was full of excitement, and the prospect of doing it again, and maybe not doing it completely as a kind of reflex, was really exciting to me. So I although it was weird, change of metabolism almost, at the same time it did feel like it suited me.
Yeah, that's a scary prospect, I think, for actors. But if you've got that thing that you know you're good at and you're like, actually this is exciting, as you say, I can imagine you then drawn in, and you feel like when you're on set, I suppose that you're still, it's very close to what you were doing. You're still getting to work with those actors, and you're still getting to sort of experiment. And in terms of the writing, I find it really interesting what the process is for how you talked about Othello getting made, but what was the kind of, you wrote the script.
Well,
how did you convince
Shakespeare did the first draft? Shakespeare did the first draft.
Yeah.
You know,
it was all right, but
it was okay. Yeah. You know,
to actually get the film made and off the ground, what was the process of convincing people to actually, you know, take on the script? Was it as simple as getting someone like Kenneth Branagh involved?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I'd gone to a few other actors once I was developing the project, and it had a very particular kind of energy. I cut a lot of stuff because I just felt the need to keep the kind of pace, the thriller pace to it. So, and I did see it quite visually. So the script, I think, reflected quite a lot of that. And, but it was, although it seems from your position, it's like, what a weird first choice as a movie. But actually, it was a good moment. Ken himself had blazed a trail with his Henry V. And so actors were interested in it. And certainly he was, you know, when I got what you call letters of intent from a really good cast, which helped me package the project. Then I said it to Ken, and Ken's sudden enthusiasm just lifted it. And then going to America, all that happened. And then from going to see Lawrence Fishburne, Castle Rock summoned me. There were various people who wanted to make the movie already. So it was very lucky because to have that, and it wasn't a big budget by their standards. I went into the meeting, I remember, and it was really, and apparently they'd wanted to see the whites of my eyes. Who is this guy coming in? And so I was kind of, I'm ready. Come on, what's the fucking question? And and actually, it never really happened. There was a moment where they said, "What was it? What's next?" And I said, "Well, we need to offer Lawrence a pay or play." That's what would trigger the casting in there. And they said, "Well, why don't you go ahead and do that?" It was like, does that mean you're saying you'll give us the money? And I almost blanked out. I mean, Luke Rowe had been on it with me for a while. Nick Rowe's son is a great fella, and we'd partnered for a while, and terrific producer now. And David Barron, who was the other producer who worked with Ken, who's done Harry Potter and things, great. And I'd worked with him before when I was an actor, so it was a good little team. Luke tells me that after we looked at each other, it's like, I think that means they're giving us the green light. And they said, "So how many characters in this show?" And I went, "Pardon?" And I wasn't really hearing. He said, no, I mean, how many? I went, "Pardon?" And they said, "What, like 15, 20? And I went, "Sure," apparently. And then bang, got back into it. But it was like, Jesus Christ, because I've been developing a few other things and trying to make them and not opening doors at all. Done some other little adaptations and written some short stories into short films. And so it's like, I got so used to pushing at the door, and suddenly, whoa, the door just flew open. And it like landed flat on my face in a way. And it was astonishing. And so it was lucky. You know, a big part of this luck is that Ken was prepared to do it. He had to do it at that time. We had to move right then. Shakespeare wasn't an anathema, which at certain times it had been. They were ready for that, and to get that combination of a Brit and an American. There were a lot of things about it that made it exciting. So I was, but, and I wasn't that aware of that. I wasn't, you know, shrewd enough commercially to be aiming for that, but, or maybe instinctively, the connection between me seeing what was missing in Milford Haven and what perhaps an audience out there might want is a populist sensitivity. I think I have a bit of that. While I'm not particularly commercially minded, I do like finding things. I like finding complicated things and making them simple. And sometimes the opposite, finding something looks simple and making it see what's complicated about. So that taking something, taking it, the journey of it, taking a bit of classic theatre, which is how I started, and try and make that available and accessible. I really love that journey because, and try to blow a bit of dust off it, because it feels like, having been an actor and felt the passion in those pieces, I wanted that somehow to come across to a much bigger audience.
That Othello is, sorry, I'm making it about me again, obviously. I did an adaptation of Othello, and I played Iago. Ah. So it's funny how you obviously played Iago when you did it as well, but what an amazing, I mean, that part is so good. Incredible. No wonder why, you know, Kenneth Branagh wanted to play that part.
Yeah.
It's one of the all-time kind of great villains, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now for a quick break. Are you a writer and director, actor, costume designer, perhaps makeup artist? Are you interested in camera? This is the place to share your journey. We want to hear from you. How did you start your career? Has it started yet? And perhaps, if you're feeling brave, share with us your most embarrassing film-related moment. So slip into our DMs at Life and Film Pod on Instagram. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm, where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, at Life and Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge, Life and Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the down times. And I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet, or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm.
And back to the show. We're going from Othello and then further down the line with the other films that you did, like obviously you've done things like the Johnny English sequel and Dad's Army and things like that, very different films, but quintessentially English, very, very sort of iconically English. What's it like going from, you know, obviously it's a few years later, but doing something like Johnny English, which is essentially a comedy action movie, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah.
Is that a very different discipline to Shakespeare?
Yes, it is, actually. I mean, it's a bit surreal. My CV does read a bit like some maniac has mashed together a completely different genre. But I wonder what sometimes, not long ago I thought this, it may be the actor in me, that actually I almost see films as parts.
Yeah.
I almost see, be interesting to inhabit this character, which is a film, to be in there. And really, I really like to mix it up and learn about new things, you know, when you go. And I've always loved comedy. So I didn't really, obviously Othello's not that funny, but I like to mix it up in the same way I was talking about complexity and simplicity. There's a way in which finding comedy in darker things is really interesting, and giving depth to comedic things is fun. So with the Rowan sequel, actually had Hamish McCall, who's a good friend, wrote that, and he really, for me, actually found some, I mean, it's not the most profound piece in the world, but it gave some real character to it and heart. That's the thing I'm always looking for, is where's the heart of the story and the heart of the character. And because I wasn't sure about doing it at all, actually, but it was a real kind of eye opener in terms of much bigger budget than anything I had. So I did get to do action sequences, and it was sort of five times the budget I'd had before. So from that point of view, it was a real experience, and working with an absolute kind of master in Rowan was fascinating too. And comedy, I've always kind of had a handle on. I love, if you like, the construction even of a joke, and there's no better kind of engineer of wit than Rowan. He analyzes it to the finest degree. And so real pleasure actually working with him. Not always easy, because he's self-confessed, you know, perfectionist, and but not from kind of vanity, prima donna-y kind of thing, more just driven to get what he thinks is right, you know. And I think that's laudable and quite exciting, you know. And sometimes you're on take 23, Rowan, and he finds something, like he'd been snuffling for something, and there on deep underground he brought up something, wow, shiny and funny, you know. Yeah. And so you take your head off of that. So yeah, learned a lot. But actually, I do like, you know, I really do like trying to do different things. Great Escaper is more like a love story between old people, and a drama, and completely different tone again. But terrific writer Billy Ivory threads it with wit as well, so it's been a pleasure. It's one of those deceptively broad pieces you think might be, and I thought it was going to be when it was heading my way. I heard what the story was, I thought, oh god, it's going to be a bit predictable. But actually, he really gave it depth and heart and all the things I like to try and find, you know.
Right, as soon as we've had some grub, I'll take you for a spin along the front. And when we get back, I think they've got a male stripper for you.
What?
I made that last bit up.
I want to go to France.
What are you on about?
The trip to the beaches, D-Day. I'm really sorry, Bernie. You left it too late.
I couldn't leave you all on your own.
Unless you have to.
Where is he? He's disappeared off the face of the earth.
He's in France.
Bonjour.
At 90. Well, he has done it before. Only then, of course, they were shooting at him.
So determined to honour his fallen comrade, the D-Day veteran made a break for the coast and mounted what has now been dubbed the Great Escape.
Who are these people?
They're Germans.
Oh, this was your beach.
Yeah.
Me too.
At your age, Adele, you cling to every second. And every second is worth clinging to.
I'm sorry, really. I've been in the papers. I've been on TV. 90-year-old coffin dodger. Honours the glorious dead. What a waste. Hey? What a waste.
If you want to honour your friend, Bernie, you've spent 70 years loving me.
I'd go anywhere with you.
We have never wasted one second of our time together. Are you coming to bed?
Yours or mine?
Oh.
And what's it like working with someone like that when you, I guess you hadn't met him before working with him? That kind of image of Michael Caine, you know, like Get Carter and the Italian Job and things like that. It must be a bit mind-blowing when you're suddenly on set and then you're directing this kind of, you know, icon.
Mm.
What's that experience like?
Well, it's pretty quickly it gets forgotten because particularly when you know, we had a 30-day shoot, so it was fast.
Wow.
And so you're really focused on getting it. And Michael is frail, you know, he's about to be 90 next month. No, this month.
Wow.
90, yeah. And he'd had an operation, so he was frail, getting stronger as the show went on, which was fabulous. It was even if the film's no good, it's been wonderful physio. You know, he's kind of moving better and alive because, you know, it came after COVID where quite a lot of older actors wondered whether that was their lot, whether they were going to get any more parts, when would there be another chance? And but he leapt at it when we got there, and he was kind of wonderful. But there are moments where it's like, oh, Jesus, what's that voice? That's Michael Caine. Yeah, and you do hear it. It's very recognizable.
Yeah.
And one kind of on alert that it doesn't swallow up the scene, because then if you're not careful, it's not that it goes to pastiche, but it takes you out of the picture a bit. On Johnny English, I had a kind of bean alert. I wanted it not to be
very good.
Try and pull back from that. That's a different character. Let's keep Johnny.
Yeah.
And with Michael, it's just, and he was a very brave thing to do for a guy his age, not wanting to, you know, it's quite exposing in a way to be playing a frail old man. And having been so very opposite and virile and kind of magnetic, he's still deeply magnetic. I mean, that's the wonderful. There are moments where you go, oh, I'm just getting a glimpse of something which is, oh, that's kind of charisma or that's presence. And somewhere deep in there, because I think he was slightly short of confidence to start with because of this thing of, am I strong enough? Am I? And as he got into it, you could see it. And then you'd see these moments where it was actually very beautiful how he would, the confidence allowed him never really to rush. So when you think of his voice and it's going at like three words at a time, and then he talks a bit like that, it's because he's really thinking and feeling it through. And it was amazing to watch him. He would never feel rushed or panicked, you know, and it was just, so he was entirely there, entirely present. And even when, because it wasn't always easy for him at all. And, you know, a lot of lines, big part, carrying a lot of stuff, but he would never fluster. And so, yeah, and the times you did just see, and it would, so he would kind of glow as a character and do, you know, he's done so many bloody films. And I remember as a young actor reading his books and some of the techniques he was passing over even then, you know, look at the eye nearest the camera when you're looking at someone off screen, don't blink. And I was watching him do all this. What does this remind me of, that book? Yeah. And it was sort of fabulous to watch him doing all that. But, and in the end, you know, I mean, I think he's given a fantastic performance and matched, I have to say, by Glenda Jackson, who is just sensational. Now, do you know Glenda Jackson? I mean,
I looked up really the film and I recognize her face, but as a younger, but I can't think what she kind of.
She's won a couple of Oscars. So she did Women in Love, for example.
Right.
Famous for doing Queen Elizabeth and a series on television. She's an amazing actress. And they had acted together actually 45 years ago. It's their reunion. And she is 86 and quite a lot smaller than she was, but no less ferociously passionate and energetic. I mean, Jesus, she was fantastic. And they were great together. So, well, I look forward to you seeing it. I think it's
definitely
something special about it.
Yeah, I just liked the looking up and looking into what the project was. So I wasn't sure if a few years back there was kind of rumors that Michael Caine was going to retire, and it was probably around that time with the COVID and everything else. So I was so pleased to see that he had this credit coming out. And
well, Funny Woman happened for me when Michael had to pull out the first time to have the operation. So I was going to be doing it 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then he couldn't do it. And so I came on Funny Woman, and then it turned up. He came back again, and it was great, as you say, to see him resurrect back on screen, you know.
Didn't he break his ankle or something? I remember hearing something about he'd sort of broken something or...
Well, it was his back. He has a bad back and to do with the leg. So, but the operation went well. It just takes a while to recover enough strength.
Fair enough. I mean, it's commendable, the amount of, like, the fact he's still so prolific and working. Mm-hmm. He must be doing at least a film a year. Like, he seems...
I think that may be his last one. Maybe. Really? Talking about it, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, you know, we'll see, because it's a brilliant part for him. The writer, yeah. Billy Ivory, really created something very special. Right. And Michael recognized that, and it fitted him so well. He's an old soldier, and Michael has been a soldier and working class, and a lot of things fell into place. And so it was a kind of dream part. So I think he's still working out. He may find it hard not to do more, but there was definitely a moment where he thought, okay, stop there.
Yeah.
Well,
if you think of people like Peter O'Toole and movies like Venus, where, you know, the joke is that he's always playing corpses and in films as an actor and things like that. I guess it must get to that point as an actor when you get to a certain age that the parts, it's rare to get something. Obviously that part sounds like it was very a meaty part with lots of dialogue, and that must be a rare thing, I guess. But I mean, yeah, commendable to keep going like that and have, I mean, the endurance just to be on set and the hours and everything else is just, that's insane. I mean, what a legend.
Yeah.
But he's like one of the sort of most iconic figures in film.
One of the few real stars left at the moment, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Of course, we have the Tom Cruises and all that, but sort of that
general, different,
feel, yeah.
Amazing. And I wanted to ask you, you've obviously worked with Gemma Arterton several times, obviously in Funny Women being the most recent. How that was the first movie you did together? Was it Saint Trinian's? How did that? I mean, it's nice when you have someone that you obviously can collaborate and you trust and you can do multiple projects with. How did that come about the first time around? Was it like a normal casting situation for Saint Trinian's?
Yeah, we had a terrific casting director, Lucy Bevan, who's one of the top ones. You'll know her probably, but she had her ear to the ground very much for young talent. And Gemma was still finishing at drama school, and I just saw her and thought, this young woman is incredible and had such self-possession and such kind of wit and natural glamour, kind of authority, and also this great spirit, real kind of energy and fun. And so, in fact, I haven't worked with her enough. I did two centuries, and there's a big gap until Funny Woman. And Funny Woman sort of came out of the blue when Michael wasn't available that first time. And I wasn't sure about the idea, but then when Gemma was there, and then I realized we had great producers in Gail Egan and Andrea Calderwood, and Morwenna had written it, who I knew of, never met her actually. So it was a whole package, but Gemma, particularly for me, I just thought this actually fits her. So well, and people haven't seen that side to her, where I feel like I've always seen it. There's a kind of effervescence and kind of fearlessness. We've seen some of that, but not so much the kind of real joie de vivre which she has. That's how we cast her, really, from nowhere. It's her first job. And
That was literally like the first thing she did then.
Centrinus was great for that, because a lot of first jobs for a lot of people, or very early ones, you know, and so it was really nice to give that opportunity. People like Paloma Faith was in it, you know, hadn't done anything, you know. It's a really weird mix, and it was just a sort of, there was a kind of energy at that moment, and we're scouring the place looking for talent, and it was of it. So it was really fun.
I have to say, I'm a big fan of a lot of your films, because they seem to, when I was growing up, like obviously Saint Trinian's and like Johnny English as well, big fan of all three of those, but Saint Trinian's is particularly like poignant. I don't know, I think I'd just come out of school, I was like basically starting my acting journey, and it was one of those films that when I watched it, I was like, oh, there's loads of people well, they look like my age. They may be slightly older or whatever, but I remember watching it thinking, oh, it'd be amazing to be in something like that. And it really was. It was one of those movies I went to see in Guildford Odeon. I remember it really well. And I remember Gemma Arterton at the time not knowing who she was and seeing her and thinking, who's that? She's going to be a star. She had that real kind of presence. And then I remember seeing her and like she popped up in Rock and Roller and then obviously the Bond film. And then like from there, she's become this like, you know, huge star. But it's nice to see that she's now gone into like a bit of producing as well. And
yeah,
and she's making her own projects and they all seem to be really great.
And reproducing Just had a child.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, no, congratulations.
She's diversifying all over the way. Yeah. And she's got, because also she's deceptively smart. I mean, really quick to get things and really on it. And we'll make, you know, she's clearly a great producer. She was never really intruded in this. She had her producing partners with her. But when they always listened, always had something. Great. But it was a lovely, I mean, you met Tom as well. And yeah, you spoke to him, I believe, when I saw your list.
No, he came on the show.
He's
as well.
Great. There was some lovely, lovely cast in the show. It was a real pleasure to work with so many of them. You know,
how long was the process? Because it's quite, you know, it's not like just doing a movie. There's 8 episodes, is there?
It was six.
Six. Yeah. I should know that.
Felt like it.
I'm in the last one. I should know that. But that's, you know, that's
just didn't stop watching after that. Yeah.
Well, that was the problem. I had to watch the whole thing. No, I really enjoyed it. And it's actually nice to watch something that you don't know what's gonna happen. Because I'd read the scripts, obviously, but I had no part of any other episode. So getting to watch it, I could just enjoy it.
Yeah,
good. Having to sort of analyze everything. So I really actually enjoyed watching it. But that's a big chunk of your life going off and doing something that long. What was the timescape for that?
Well, actually, it's no more than a film because it was so fast.
Wow,
yeah.
Really?
I mean, we shot it. It was a longer schedule in terms of shooting. So what did we have? I think it was 66 days. So about 11 days, something like that. Is that 11 days an episode? So it's fast.
Yeah, that is fast.
I know. Wow. We were really having to race through that.
Yeah. Well, now I understand how quick my scene was. I was like,
oh my God. No, the whole thing was like that. So it was a kind of really.
I thought it was a one-off.
No, vigorous. Every scene.
Wow.
And which, you know, ideally things would be a little bit more prepared with more time, but it's quite difficult, you know, when a commissioner goes, here's the start dates and you've got this much time to write the next few episodes. So everyone was working full tilt, but actually, you know, really good team. There's some kind of users to hear that because I don't want to have fewer days to shoot. But the hell for leather occasionally gives you a kind of, you knee jerk, you go for what's essential. You have to really think, how do we get to the core of this scene quick, you know, and that's very bracing, you know, and you don't always get it. So it's much more compared to films where been lovely on this film, just done, where it's actually rather a brilliant DP, Chris Ross, beautifully designed. A lot of people really, it's, and then you can finesse it and you're really working with the attention to detail, the TV thing. Because TV doesn't have that, so it's a kind of much more kind of rowdy, energetic, slightly chaotic, bracing, but a lot of fun. And you catch, and you know, I'd have to say in the middle of it was Gemma, and it couldn't work without her amazing kind of full throttle energy and courage. You know, she was brilliant. We couldn't have got through what we did without her. Astonishing kind of just throw yourself right in the middle of it. I remember in the first day of shooting, it's like, blimey, it's going to be like that, is it? You know, and it was, and all the boys around, she was doing her audition scene at the beginning, they were kind of, you could see that it was like G-force. So fantastic.
Amazing. Well, that's incredible. I didn't realize it was that quick. That's amazing.
Very fast. So actually the whole thing was the length of a film, really.
Yeah. That, yeah, madness. I thank you so much for coming on here. I've got a few more things I want to ask you, so I will wrap it up. Most embarrassing moments,
yeah. Embarrassing moments. I wish I could. I probably burnt them all from my...
Deleted them.
Let me think. As an actor, I'm sure... Oh, yeah, there were some as an actor. what was it? I was in the West End, Helena, what I'm calling the show. It was, it was the first night, I think. And at the very end, we were meant to waltz. Was it? Oh, no, I was meant to waltz with Sarah Brightman, who was in it. And Helena was meant to play the piano. And it's going to this elegant thing, and everybody's meant to come and join us. We're all dancing in couples around the stage. So it must have been Helena who came to dance. So that's right. So we got to the end, and Helena goes to play the piano, and no sound comes out. So she does a bit of this, put the sound right, and then you get up to join me, and I was thinking, what's happening? The audience has started, and then suddenly she went, whispered in my ear, "Fuck it, let's dance!" Right? We just had the dance, right? And we were dancing to a waltz without any time. We thought, I think we're doing all right. And then the other actors, I mean, to come and join, completely in the wrong place. And didn't know what, everyone's looking. And the audience are now starting to really laugh. And then the music comes on. It's entirely different place. And so it was like, kind of first night, we're sorry, you know. So it's like, that one will sort of seared into my memory.
When you're on stage as well, and there's nothing, you just like, well, you're going to have to just go for it now.
Fuck It, Let's Dance should be Helena's autobiography, I think. That was very liberating.
Or it could be yours.
Yep, could nick it.
Oliver, thank you so much. This has been wicked. And I really appreciate it, because I know you've been so busy. We got there. We finally got there. And thank you so much, man.
Pleasure.
I'll let you go. Take care, man.
Take care now.
Bye.
Bye. It's a laugh and film, motherfucker. Subscribe
and like and follow. Thank you to our guest, Oliver. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, BetterHelp.